strong for over 40 years now, with a continuous program of bringing lectures on philosophical and other intellectual topics to the public in Dallas-Fort Worth. And our mission is basically to present as wide a variety of ideas as we possibly can for people to come and absorb and interact and maybe ask a question or two about. How many are here at your first Dallas Philosophers Forum lecture? Great, welcome. And those around these folks, be sure and make them welcome and at home. We do this twice a month during the academic year. And there's a schedule that Carla back there has. If you didn't get one, that'll kind of tell you. We're almost at the end of this semester, but it'll tell you what's coming up next month. And we do take up a $5 admission charge to defray our expenses. We are an all-volunteer nonprofit organization, but we do have certain expenses to defray, so we pay for them that way. And if you'd like to become a regular subscriber, a six-month subscription is $35, which is quite a break on the price. So we'll have about, 45 minutes to an hour of presentation, and then we'll have about 30 minutes of Q&A time. So we'll ask you to hold your questions to the end, and I'll moderate recognizing questioners, try to give everybody a chance. So I think that's our business of the evening. So it's my pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague Rob Olson, who has served as president of this organization very ably for the last couple of years. But in his day job, Rob is a senior research analyst with International Risk Management Institute, which is a risk management publishing company, and is the author and the principal research analyst for their publication, Personal Risk Management and Insurance. Rob earned a BA degree cum laude in economics and also has a Master of Liberal Arts degree with emphasis in philosophy, both from Southern Methodist University here locally, and holds the Chartered Property Casualty Underwriter, CPCU, certification, and is a very active member of that society. He's held a number of chairmanships and offices, including being a past president of the Dallas chapter, and currently he's the national governor for the CPCU Society. Rob has been recognized twice by the Insurance Institute of America for outstanding outstanding scholarly achievements, and serves as an adjunct professor at SMU and the University of North Texas teaching risk management classes. And is active in community services, teaching life enrichment classes to inmates and jailers at the Dallas County Jail. So, glad to present tonight, Rob Olson.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Am I on now?
You're on.
Am I on now?
Yes.
You folks hear me in the back okay? No?
It's not working, but we can
hear you. Just slide it up.
I can start yelling, I guess.
It should be working.
It still shows red here, Ken.
Yeah, you're on now.
Well, here.
Am I on now?
Well, let me make sure it's on the right channel. No, that's right.
How's that?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's still loud.
A little loud. Is that what happened on the right channel?
I'm sorry. Well, okay, well, thank you so much for having me speak for this group. The topic is the world in 2034, ethical conundrums, challenges, and issues. And I've made this presentation many times, but from the risk management side. And what are the risk management and insurance implications? And so I thought it'd be kind of fun to say, well, what are the, instead of the risk management implications, what are the ethical implications of this new world that we're going to be seeing in the next 10, 15, 20 years? But I begin this presentation with some trepidation, because who can really predict what's going to happen in 20 years. It's fraught with peril. But I figure, if my predictions have come true in 20 years and you seek me out in 20 years, I'll give you your $5 back. I don't think you'll remember it that far.
In 20 years, it'll be worth $100.
Yeah, that's right.
I won't be here. That's not fair.
You won't be here. You'll
be here, Bob.
So we're going to talk about the exponential growth of computer software and hardware, the amazing growth in the power of computer hardware is just staggering. We're going to talk about the exponential growth there. We're going to talk about some trends in genetics, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, robotics, and then explore some of the ethical implications and challenges of these trends. So I usually have learning, because I teach, I always have learning objectives, but I just,
I think you got to aim at your computer.
So I mentioned the dangers of predictions. So here's a few. Yogi Bear said it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. Headlines like that. The telephone has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. The device is of inherently no value to us.
It's true.
Western Union internal memo in 1876. Heavy air flying machines are impossible, per the president of the Royal Society in 1895. And most of you have probably seen this one. Everything that can be invented has been invented, according to the Commission of the U.S. Office of Patents. Who the hell wants to hear actors talk? Larry Warner, and I think there's a world market for maybe 5 computers per computer by IBM in 1940. And these are serious, dead serious comments. So who is this guy? Arguably the first futurist. Leonardo da Vinci. Exactly. So has anybody seen some of his illustrations? There's some amazing illustrations. Helicopters and different flying machines, hang gliders, there's parachutes, submarines, an early form of a car. I mean, just some amazing, unbelievable ideas that generated from this genius. Here's another futurist, Jules Verne. He accurately predicted that man would go to the moon before the 20th century was over. And he just said they would need gunpowder rather than rocket fuel. But he accurately predicted skyscrapers. He accurately predicted the type of the television, a forerunner of an internet, that type of communication. All sorts of amazing, elevators, all sorts of amazing things that he accurately predicted back in the 1860s. So a couple of quotes on technology. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And then this is one I really like. Technology is too is that? What do we have? Technology is anything invented after you. So we're going to be talking about the law of accelerating returns. Okay, so you can compare linear to exponential. Okay, so linear, 30 steps takes you to the number 30. Okay. No, we got some technology right back here. Exponential, 30 steps, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. Where does 30 steps take you? Anyone want to take a guess?
To the 30. Billions.
Billion. Over a billion. Okay. And so this is tied into the exponential growth of CPU speed and the number of pixels on a camera, the speed of various microprocessors. It just keeps doubling. And this is predicated on, Moore's Law. Okay, I'm going to get to Moore's Law in just a minute. So the story of chess, this is perhaps apocryphal. Some say it was invented in Persia. Others say, well, it might have been invented in China. But one of the stories, like I say, it's probably apocryphal, was that a man invented this game, chess, and he brought it to the king. And the king was so impressed with this game that he said, give me your award you want. And whatever you want, I'll give it to you. And the man said, okay. Well, I would like, let me see if my pointer's working. I'd like a grain of rice on each square, and then doubles after each square. So by the time there are 128, 256, 512, 1024, the king said, that's pretty simple. That's a pretty modest request, this grain of rice. He said, don't you want some women in the evening? Don't you want gold? Don't you want, other things? I mean, this is an extremely modest request. And the man said, no, this is what I want. So by the time you get down here, you're talking about just gigantic bushels of rice. It starts off with a few here, there, and then a bit of cup, and then quarts, and then gallons, and before you know it, that when you get down to the last square, it would be, the amount of rice necessary would be, if every single square foot of the planet, including the oceans, had about 4 rice fields in it. Okay, so the theory is the king had to keep doubling it and doubling it, though that supposedly he had the man beheaded because he didn't want to keep paying for that rice. But this is tied to Moore's law, okay? The observation that over the history of computer hardware, the number of transistors on the integrated chip doubles about every 18 to 24 months. So if you think about my fingernail, there's about over 100 million transistors that could be packed into my fingernail. You could have that high-powered microchip receivers. And a transistor is like a switch or like a gate that it's off or on, and it controls the power, or it's one of the aspects of controlling the power and the speed of computers. And so these transistors, the number of these is doubling every 18 to 24 months. So we're going to talk about, and I read a book called Ray Kurzweil, The Singularity is Near. This really got me into this. Has anybody read The Singularity is Near by Kurzweil? Oh, a bunch of you all have read it. Okay. Not as many people in the insurance business or risk management business have read Ray Kurzweil, but I figured there'd be some Ray Kurzweil fans here. And it's just such a great read. He's arguably one of the greatest futurists in America, great inventor. And he talked about these 4 particular trends. And so I just love that book so much. I just started reading more and more books about this topic. So we're going to talk about each of these four, and we're going to talk about the implications and some potential ethical conundrums as a result of this. So genetics, start with genetics. What is genetics? The branch of biology that deals with heredity, we all know that. The scientific study of how genes control the characteristics of animals or plants. And in my risk management talks, I always talk about how this whole concept of nature versus nurture is really the wrong question, because as most of us know, we are a combination of genetics and environment, and the two are interacting with each other constantly from the moment of conception. And so it's not just one of those. Does anybody remember the Three Stooges where they had, you know, a big debate? Yeah, I love that Three Stooges. You know, had a big debate about whether it's, you know, is it environment or is it genetics? It's an outmoded way of thinking. So the Human Genome Project, the largest collaborative biological project ever, $3 billion was spent on this project, started in about 1990. And they thought, okay, it's going to take us 10 or 12 years to do it. And the first, five or six years, they were only getting 1 or 2% of it done. And they kept thinking, okay, if this continues this way, it's going to take us 200 years to map the human genome. But what made the difference was that the computer hardware just kept doubling every 18 to 24 months. Once again, that comes up. Moore's Law, sort of like all the Ten Commandments wrapped into one. Silicon Valley's Ten Commandments wrapped into one. And so the cost of DNA sequencing just dropped dramatically. And these supercomputers, they just started sequencing faster and faster and faster. And the project was done within 10 years. And so the idea is with this type of genome, the personalized medicine, using a person's DNA map to predict disease and personalized treatment. We'll talk more about this in a minute. Nanotechnology, I love this quote, Louis Pasteur, the role of the infinitely small is infinitely large. So nanotechnology, as we know, is the study of manipulating matter on an atomic or molecular scale, and it's 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter, 100,000 times thinner than a strand of normal hair, kind of like my hair here. It's very, very, very thin. So let's talk about the size of the nanometer. So imagine that you were able to miraculously get 7.2 billion people, all the people on the planet, 7.2 billion people miraculously to gather around a thimble. Okay? And they're putting a hydrogen atom in that thimble every second. So you got 7.2 million hydrogen atoms going into that thimble every single second. How long does it take to fill up the thimble? Like this? About 50 years, a little more than 50 years. That gives you an idea of how just amazingly tiny. I can't get my arms around it. Just like when you try and imagine big space, you know, I just can't get my arms around that either. But a nanometer is to a meter like a marble is to the Earth. So that's a different, another perspective on that. There's over 1,000 manufacturer-identified nanoproducts using sunscreen, surface coatings, like a lot of motorcycle engine and regular engine parts will be coated with nanomaterials. Okay? It's starting to be used in cosmetics ladies. So it's getting bigger and bigger and used in some food products as well on this. So all the regulatory issues are going to come up that's going to be pretty fascinating to follow. Robotics, another key trend. So it's advanced of technology dealing with the design, construction, operation, application of robots and their computer systems. And right now they're taking place in humans in dangerous environments, manufacturing processes, dangerous, dirty, boring environments. BMW is using it, over 500 robots in their assembly line. Now the fine type of work, buffing and certain things that require really fine motor skills, human beings are still doing that. But BMW is hoping down the road that these robots are going to become more and more dexterous in their ability. One of my colleagues that I ran into at a risk management conference, his mother's an RN, and she was moving an obese patient 4 years ago, moving from one bed or moving from part of the bed to another part of the bed, and hurt her back really bad, slip disc, hernia disc. She's been on worker comp disability since then. So the idea is that can the robots of the future move these patients? And that would be a huge savings as far as the workers' comp side and the pain and suffering side and all. So one of the weaknesses of robots, they lack what's called strong artificial intelligence. Okay, what we mean by that is the type of intelligence that we have, where we can shift gears and we can make decisions based on logic and based on common sense and based on various creative things. The standard robots or the artificial intelligence, they can do something that's real simple and straightforward extremely well, like play chess or play Jeopardy. We'll talk about the Jeopardy contest that happened in 2011. They lack intuition, they lack creativity, they lack common sense. Some of them are not very good at pattern recognition. Obviously, they lack consciousness. Ray Kurzweil wants to change that. The futurist. But here is Baxter, right? And he is pretty cool, a robot. Let's see if I can get my computer.
Check out his eyes, though. I like his eyes.
Not pretty drunk.
So with Baxter, effects, or the idea is for people to be able to, regular workers, back to workers, to be able to show Baxter the moves, okay? No programming involved. A lot of the robots now have to have complex programming in order to operate. They have to be separated from all the other workers, okay? But the idea with Baxter is that he can show him what to do, and he can learn from these factory workers. So the idea is that the factory workers will be collaborators. There won't be traditional factory workers in 10 or 20 years. They will be collaborators, and they will be robotics trainers. Okay? So a factory worker in 20 years, they might, their title might be, I'm a robot trainer. And so I believe it's Amazon that's working with these little GoBots. Has anybody seen this? I think it was on 60 Minutes a while back. And so they try and replicate the activity of ants or termites as far as how they work together. You can have thousands of these at some of the Amazon centers. They're still doing some experimenting with that. But they work in these major gigantic warehouses. And they pick up various pallets. They're all trained in what to do. They all, I don't have a video on it, but they all work seamlessly together. And you can go onto YouTube and see a video on it. So there are many robots. I tried to get the video for this one. It was just like, okay, this is a 50s movie of the robot that was attacking people and all that. I had trouble with the video. So, artificial intelligence. So what is artificial intelligence? Most of us know this. The intelligence machines and computer science that lies behind this intersection of machines and human intelligence. So an intelligent agent is a system that perceives its environment and takes action that maximizes its chances of success. Does anybody know when the whole concept of artificial intelligence began? It's the year I was born, so 1956. And the question is the impact on simple analyst jobs in the future, okay? So a lot of us hope that, okay, if I get a good education, work really hard, then I too will be a simple analyst. That's the term that a lot of computer scientists use. I'm not going to be a factory worker where I can be replaced by a robot. Okay, but it could be in 10, 15, 20, 30 years that with artificial intelligence that they will replace some of these simple analyst type of positions. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So artificial intelligence yesterday, Mary Shelley. Does anybody know the story about Frankenstein? Mm-hmm. It's pretty, yeah, you know the story? What's the story?
He learns from Milton. Like, his education is Paradise Lost.
Yeah. Well, the story that I read was that Mary Shelley, when she was 18, they were telling scary stories with her husband-to-be, Percy Shelley, and Lord Byron, the poet. And they were up late one night, and they said, wait, let's have a bet. Who can write the scariest story? And so Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, Prometheus, when she was 18. And it's one of the greatest novels, one of the greatest stories I've ever read. It's just excellent. And so it deals with this idea of, can this machine have a consciousness? Can he have feelings? So she was one of the early writers about what we're going to be talking about tonight as far as this artificial intelligence that grows more and more powerful and can take on a life of its own, and that's what the singularity is sort of about. And this is artificial intelligence today. So I mentioned this a second ago. Who is this? Watson, right? Watson beat the top two Jeopardy champions of all time, and beat them fairly solidly. Watson spent years reading all this vast literature and learned similes and puns and, you know, play on words and metaphors and read millions of books and was able to soundly defeat these Jeopardy champions. Since that was 2011, and now supposedly he's 1,000 times more powerful today than he was 2011. So he's now going to medical school. Okay. So the idea is that if you were to expect your doctor to read the top flight medical journals in his or her area of specialization every week, how long would it take your doctor to read all that? Any ideas?
More time he's got available.
About 80 hours. Okay. So let's say your doctor's an oncologist. It would take him or her 80 hours of solid reading to read the top flight medical journals in oncology or radiology or whatever dermatology, whatever it happened to be. Okay? So Watson can do that in his sleep and using big data to diagnose and treat patients. So the idea is, once again, I mentioned factory workers and robots being collaborators. Now with Watson, with big data, with these supercomputers, the idea is that the doctors and Watson will be collaborators. Okay. So it's kind of cool. Let's say that you're a poor person and you live out in West Texas. And you're having heart symptoms and there's no cardiologist where you're at. You go to your local MD. He or she will maybe in 20 years, maybe in 15 years, that MD will be able to tap into something like Watson, an artificial intelligence, an expert system, put in the symptoms, and that doctor, collaborating with the artificial intelligence, will be in a good position to provide a good diagnosis and a treatment plan for that individual that lives out in West Texas. Okay. So it's kind of exciting to think about how that type of collaboration can occur down the road. So I was reading about Siri, sort of artificial intelligence, and how many have played around Siri on their cell phones a little bit. So you ask Siri or ask Google what's the depth of the Red Sea, of course, 7,254 feet. But if you ask where is Elvis buried, and it says, I don't recognize Elvis buried. So he thought that buried was the second name, the last name for Elvis. Why did the chicken cross the road? It's like, I'm sorry, but I don't have any knowledge about the motivation chickens. And then can a crocodile play basketball? Now, a four-year-old could answer that question, right? Three or four-year-old. But instead, they give you the website of a girls' basketball team in Florida. They're the Crocodiles. So it didn't really answer the question. So there's some limitations for artificial intelligence. So now what I want to do is look at those four trends and apply it to some industries, some medicine, transportation, agriculture, manufacturing, and housing. Medicine of the future. And we have several doctors here. Charlie's here. There's a few other doctors usually that come. You can correct me on whatever I say here. I'm not a doctor. What will medicine look like in 2034? Longevity medicine. What's the fastest age group in America? Fastest growing age group in America.
Centenarians.
Yeah, over 100. I was at an insurance conference a while back, and I talked to a man who's 102 years old, and he was sharp as a whip. He had a walker, but he was sharp. I asked him if he remembered Silent Cal. It's Calvin Coolidge. He said, "Oh yeah, I kind of remember Silent Cal. I remember Calvin Coolidge." Not very often you'll meet someone that remembers Calvin Coolidge as a president. Nanobots, we were talking about this at the table a little bit ago. My brother is going through follicular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And he's going through, he's 55, my younger brother. And he's going through this chemo regimen that is just absolute hell. It's just, and supposedly, this poison, this chemo, is slightly, emphasis on the term, slightly more effective on cancer cells than healthy cells. Okay, so it's flooding his whole body, and he's lethargic, he's in pain, it's just not absolutely horrible. And he said, if the cancer comes back, I don't know if I'm going to go through it again. But it could be in 15, 20, 30, 40 years with these nanotechnology that these nanobots will be able to go in directed wireless to go in and be able to zap those cancer cells on a nanotechnology basis and recognize the cancerous cells from the non-cancerous cells. Okay, so that's going to be coming. We don't know when. So robotic techniques, now they're doing, there's called the Da Vinci robot that's doing some type of cancer surgeries, but with mixed results. It's still too early. Their success rate is about the same or maybe a little bit worse than human surgeons. But it's still making progress there. Artificial intelligence, we talked about the doctor scenario in West Texas. Neuroprosthetics, okay. So that's the interface of like computer chips and the human body. Okay, so I have a friend with Parkinson's. And a couple years ago, he had a hole drilled in his skull and he had a computer chip the size of an aspirin implanted on the base of his brain, and it stimulates it stimulates and regulates his brain activity, and he's doing much better now with this neuroprosthetic. So he's a combination of biological and non-biological intelligence. Hearing aids, there's some work on cochlear implants that are going on now. I think over 200,000 people in America have cochlear implants. Pistorius. I mean, the South African runner. He was not only in the Paralympics, but he was competing against able-bodied individuals. I think he got to the second round and then he lost. But that's amazing to think about, that carbon graphite material that was on his prosthetic. So the idea is that medicine in 2034 may be P4 medicine predictive. Be able to say, okay, based on your genome, based on your DNA, and by that time, 20 years, we'll have a credit card that'll have our DNA mapping on it, or even perhaps have a computer chip with our DNA map that's injected right underneath our arm, right below the epidermis, and that will show what we're allergic to, what diseases we have, what surgeries we've had, what, you know, all these different components, and it can be updated wirelessly. So that's coming in the future. But they'll predict it, they'll personalize the medicine. So then let's say that you have, for example, there's over 100 types of cancer. Okay. Each type of cancer can be caused by tens of thousands of different mutations. We just don't know which mutations cause the different types of cancer. Okay. But if you have your own DNA map, and you juxtapose that with the DNA for that particular type of cancer, then the doctors of the future, working with artificial intelligence, working with expert systems, will be able to say, this is the right treatment plan for Ed or for Brenda or Harry. Okay. And so that's pretty exciting just to think about being able to use the technology in that way. And then preventive, okay, you may be able to take certain drugs that will reduce your chances of getting this disease or that disease. And then participatory. The idea is that with the power of the internet, that you'll be able to learn more and more about your health, and they'll take steps working with your doctor. You'll collaborate with your doctor. The doctor's going to be collaborating with a computer program with artificial intelligence to extend your life and make your life a better one. Okay, so then there's ethical issues, okay? The cost can rise more rapidly. Just think about when I was a young boy and I got injured, I had an x-ray. Now you get an MRI, right? So the technology can increase the cost. Longevity issues, end-of-life care. You can keep someone alive longer and longer and longer, but that doesn't mean their care of their quality of life is good. And then the ethical and economic implications of boosting lifespans, particularly if the life is not a quality life. And then the genetics testing, there are privacy implications that come with that. Who controls that data? Who controls the data that's implanted, the information that's implanted in your arm? And the question is, are the insurance companies going to have access to all this? And there are laws in place that forbid them from using DNA type of information to underwrite or rate your policy, but that's still a challenge for regulators. Okay, so the whole issue of amp humans or neural implants for normal people, okay? So let's just imagine someone that's epileptic, okay? And they have a computer chip, or they have a learning disability. Let's use that as an example. They have a computer chip that's implanted on the base of their, inside their skull, and it makes them super, super smart. They remember all these things, and they go from being learning disabled or learning challenge to being the star student, okay, with this kind of technology. Well, wouldn't, so then the idea is that there's a novel out, it's called, it deals with these, what's called, you know, amped humans. These neural implants that make these people that are initially are handicapped, turns them into brilliant superstars. Okay. Would it be too far-fetched for us to say, well, a rich person that has normal intelligence doesn't have any disabilities. They want to be amped as well. They want to be superstars, and they're willing to pay for that. Okay. So what are the ethical implications there? What type of regulatory issues are we going to deal with there? Should it just be for those that are handicapped, that have a disability? Or should it be open it up to everyone? So Homo sapiens is a combination, we talked about a combination of biological and non-biological intelligence. But another issue is these catastrophe cases, okay? Rationing of health care. I heard about a person that had a baby, it was about 1 pound, one pound baby. Now, Charlie, a 1 pound baby would have survived 30 years ago, right? Charlie's a doctor.
Not 30 years ago.
Yeah. Maybe not even 20 years ago. But these babies, a lot of these babies now will have all sorts of breathing problems for the rest of their life. They'll have health issues the rest of their lives, and that all goes into what we pay for in healthcare. Another issue, ethical issues, over-treatment, over-diagnosis, okay? So some of these MRI machines are getting more and more sophisticated, that they can pick out these microscopic abnormalities and make the assumption that this microscopic abnormality is what's causing your pain, when in fact it may not be causing your pain at all. So there's this over-diagnosis, over-treatment that's rampant, that's causing all these costs to go up. And so that's one of the dangers of this type of technology, is that it can see more and more and more. And just because it's an abnormality doesn't mean it's the cause of the symptoms. Okay, so I mentioned three stages. This is the wrong slide. There's the right slide. Okay, so transportation in 2034. And this is an area of risk management that I get into quite a bit. Telematics. Okay, so the insurance companies of the future are going to expect, and it's just getting bigger in the trucking field, okay? With telematics, they can determine how fast that driver is driving, if they're speeding. They can determine how fast they slam on the brakes, or how fast they accelerate, or if they take corners too fast. And so more and more employers are using this to, you know, reward drivers or penalize drivers. And the companies that are using telematics, their losses are significantly lower. Okay. A lot of truck drivers don't like it because they feel like it's Big Brother, and it's like they're losing their privacy. But they're more likely to stay on the right track. A lot of truck drivers will have accidents if they get lost, and they're trying to figure out where they're at with the state-of-the-art telematics and with the onboard GPS. They're less likely to get lost. Intelligent highways and roads and vehicle infrastructure integration. The idea is in 20 or 30 years, there'll be sensors in all these roads. Okay? And those sensors will communicate with your cars. Okay, so there'll be this infrastructure that's integrated together. And so if you're going to go, you're taking a trip, and your car, it alerts you that you're going to have to go a different route because of this. It detects the sensors, which is going to be so quickly. It detects that the sensors show that there's an accident, that all the cars are stopped on LBJ, so you're going to take a different route. Drones, the privacy and safety issues, that's going to become more and more common. The issue now is that FAA has not come up with they're supposed to develop a white paper, basically say, how are these drones going to be regulated? And so right now they make variances for some highway contractors and for the military, of course. But a drone is sort of like a flying robot, when you think about it. And yet it's going to revolutionize our world. Insurance companies are going to want to be able to use it to detect the damage, widespread damage over a big area. Or a lot of, in my business, a lot of adjusters get hurt climbing up on roofs and falling or getting injured, climbing up on roofs to adjust that roof plane, that hail plane. So drones would do away with that. They would be able to take pictures and ascertain what the damage or not. Driverless automobiles and trucks. So there's a lot of sorts of implications there. So these driverless vehicles, they have radar, they have LIDAR, different type of radar, they have sensors, they have video cameras, wide variety of different sensors and such. And so the question is, all these are controlled by these algorithms, these complex software packages, okay? So if the algorithm malfunctions and causes an accident, who's going to be liable? Okay. The manufacturer of the car that procured that software for their automobile? the developer of the algorithm, okay. But a lot of these vehicles, they have all this software from different manufacturers. And so it's got, maybe they could have 1,000 algorithms that are used for this driverless car. And Google, and y'all, we'll see a video on this in a second. But Google's had several cars, and they've driven over 500,000 miles, and they've had two accidents. Okay. Does anybody know the circumstances of the accidents? Anybody heard? One of them, they were rear-ended, so it wasn't their fault. The other one was where I think it was raining, and they don't do as well. The other one, I think it was raining, and so the Google car turned the controls back over to the human operator, and then he had an accident. So it wasn't the autonomous feature that caused the accident. But what happens if it did, okay? And then all of a sudden, you know, no, it's that algorithm that caused the accident. No, it's that algorithm that caused the accident. So they all bring in their expert witnesses. And before you know it, it can just be a morass. Okay? David, you're an attorney. Can you just... Yeah, sounds good to David, yeah.
Keep him busy for a while.
Yeah. But just think about if everyone's going to bring in their own expert witnesses, no, it's that algorithm, no, it's that algorithm. Just think about the costs involved in that. It would just be astronomical. So some possibilities would be no fault, where everyone just pays for their own losses, or some type of pooling arrangement, so that you know, it's handled that way. But it could be very, very messy. But the good news is, so far the technology seems to be working. Or what happens if it's an elderly person that is saying, I can't drive, so I can't have an autonomous car that turns the controls back over to me. I have to have an autonomous car that won't do that, that will be able to operate in rain and snowstorms, because that's one of the problems. They don't do so well in bad weather conditions. So they don't do so well like in construction zones, certain things like that. Some of them have a hard time differentiating like a little boy from a plastic bag that's in the road. So there's still a lot more work that has to be done. Way down the road, remember the Jetsons? Remember the Jetsons, the flying cars? Well, that could be 2090 or beyond. But there are 130 companies in the world that are working on flying cars. Now, some of it's related to drones, but I read that a couple places. Over 100 companies are working on flying cars. That's pretty exciting.
Pretty awesome.
Here, 95% of his vision is gone.
Yeah.
Auto losses. There's 32,000 people that die in auto accidents per year in the United States. So, collision avoidance systems, telematics. But who's going to be responsible? How is it going to be played out? How is it going to? My mom, she's 85. She would love. She doesn't like losing her independence. She really doesn't drive, but she would love to be able to have a driverless car instead of relying on me. You know, people don't want to lose their independence. And so what are the implications there? I'm gonna skip over agriculture. I don't think we have quite enough time. Let me get into manufacturing. I want to try and wrap it up in about 10 minutes. Manufacturing in 2034. So robotics, artificial intelligence, molecular nanotechnology. People will be able to do some of their own manufacturing. So Ken mentioned to me, he has a 3D printer. Ken's an engineer. He has a 3D printer, and how's that working? There's some issues.
Well, you can build it. There's different qualities, but I mean, they've got some good ones where you can just build a bunch of parts and put them together, and you've got a product that works. As a matter of fact, there's a 3D printer to place I'm working right now that built itself.
Yeah.
3D printer. They build the parts, and then they put it together.
And it uses like a type of resin, and it
right.
One layer after another, after another, after another.
Yeah.
Use different materials and all that. So down the road, we may be, ourselves may be manufacturers. But the regulations on this is really scant. And no one can agree on how these type of 3D printers should be regulated. Mm-hmm. Okay, so manufacturing more and more robots. What who's responsible if the robot causes the injury? And another issue with robotics, that one of my friends, she was a risk manager for a manufacturing company. And she said, the problem is that when it goes down, when the system goes down, nobody knows what to do. they've lost the fingertip knowledge because they don't really manufacture. They program the robots, but if the whole system goes down, if the whole automated system goes down, they're, in some cases, they're at a loss as to what to do because they've lost that fingertip knowledge. The other issue with nanotechnology, and whether it's the asbestos of the 21st century, is that with mice, when mice are exposed to these nanoparticles, one billionth of a meter, the mice start exhibiting characteristics. They exhibit breathing problems. They develop all sorts of health problems, similar to being exposed to asbestos. Okay? So that's one of the ethical implications, is that we're moving forward so fast down nanotechnology way. And yet, if it turns out that these nanoparticles are causing all these injuries to these workers, and where it's a latent injury that comes up 10 or 20 years down the road, then we're going to say, we made the wrong choice down this path. And what's interesting is that these materials, they change, when you change the scale, then they have different impacts. Okay, so when the mice were exposed to microparticles, 1 millionth of a meter, okay, copper microparticles, they didn't have any deleterious effects at all. Okay, so the properties of these materials change based on the scale. That's what's fascinating. But it's just like, okay, gravity is one of the most important laws for human beings, right? But gravity is not so important for a tiny insect, right? So it's a different scale. So will nanoparticles be the asbestos of the 21st century? And that's an ethical issue, is that if these manufacturers are going full steam ahead, and there's little or no regulation, and these people start having all these health problems, then that's really an ethical dilemma, and that's one that regulators really have to look at carefully. Life at Home, who we have here? Mr. Gates, right? So this is his vision of what a bedroom of the future might look like. So the idea is that smart homes, homes with robots, homes with monitoring devices, RFID tags, the idea is what's called the Internet of Things. the Internet of Things, mm-hmm. where everything's going to have a sensor, okay? Everything's going to be embedded. So for those of you who are business people, you're going out on a trip, you take your laptop on your trip with you, you won't have to do that in 20 years or 15 years, because there'll be computers everywhere, okay? There'll be monitors. There'll be monitors on all the walls, okay? And you'll be ready computer power, like the cloud. You're seeing that more and more. But we won't have to carry computers around with us. It'll be, the Internet of Things, it'll be ubiquitous. These computer chips will be everywhere. These sensors are everywhere. Okay? And what's interesting is that it's expected that in 10 years or maybe less, a computer chip will be the cost of a single sheet of paper. About 1 cent. Okay? And they all have their own IP address. We had a water loss in my house a couple years ago. And there was a water leak underneath the crawl space, in the crawl space of our home. Okay. Well, if we had sensors down there, then we would have known about that right away and we would have gotten it fixed. Instead, it was an $80,000 property loss. Green Homes, another big trend. I just kind of like this picture. I was like, that's a smart home. So what are the ethical implications? Libel versus bias, the Internet and social media. Look at what's going on. People are engaging in all sorts of social media, and they're getting in trouble. Loss of privacy. Problems with big data. Privacy and dictatorship of data. It's like an emphasis on the data can do no wrong, and yet there's so much bad data out there. Sort of like garbage in, garbage out. They call it the dictatorship of data. Another ethical issue is trying to use big data in prison math, okay? Based on the characteristics, based on where that person lives, based on all their prior offenses, we can predict the criminal risk, okay? But in some cases, those geographical boundaries, information, that's tied into race, okay? That it's seen as discriminatory. And big data is not infallible. Big data has to be treated with respect, and with judiciousness and with a great deal of care. So there's all sorts of ethical implications. And that's the problem with this presentation. I have to throw up more questions than I have answers. But 3D printing of illegal drugs, okay? So there's really not much regulation going on. So if you want to go print your own in your home and you've got an STL file that will do that for you, then you can print your own illegal drugs or any other type of drug, and not have the safeguards that are in place from the FDA and other regulatory bodies. Dangerous concerning robots, we talked about that. One of the fascinating ones, I think some of the philosophical issues, is the digital divide, the technology haves and have-nots. And one of the arguments is that you have a greater disparity in income, not because of tax laws, but because you've got those that can use computers and tell computers what to do, and those that are going to be told by computers what to do. So I was reading a long article about Amazon, and they're using big data to track these workers so minutely. It's like, okay, average bathroom break, you're spending too much time in the bathroom. We're tracking you, and you're averaging 45 seconds in the bathroom, and that's way too much. And so it's this microscopic control over people. You need to do this more efficiently. You need to do that more efficiently. And they're tracking their every single move. So I have some ethical problems with that, and I think a lot of people do too. Is it excessive computer monitoring with super fast computers in the cloud, with big data, and it's just such a control over these people's lives, trying to get more work out of them. Computer-assisted arbitrage in the stock market fluctuations, that's becoming more of a concern with big data. Arbitragers, they'll say, okay, here's the price of this stock, but here's the price of the future of this stock or this index, and it's a little bit off from the underlying stock values. And so if it gets a little bit more off, we're going to buy heavily or short or long sell this stock and take advantage of these minute swings in the futures price and the underlying stock. Okay. And so the concern is that's, once again, the more powerful, the powerful and knowledgeable ones, they're going to get an advantage over those that are not as computer literate. And other ethical problems, salami slicing. Is anybody familiar with what salami slicing is? People that work in a bank or people that can infiltrate a bank, they will take, with big data and supercomputers, they'll take a half a cent out of every single person's savings account per month. Okay. And no one knows. And if you do find out about it, you know, are you going to do anything about it? Okay, I lost 6 cents this year. I'm not going to press that. I'm not going to pursue that. So it's called salami slicing. So the loss of blue-collar jobs due to stunning growth in technology, second machine age, where these computers are going to take more and more control, and perhaps people will lose simple analyst jobs. My cousin is a radiologist, and he is concerned that down the road, some of his jobs with these powerful computers and this software, that they'll be able to do the type of work that he does as a radiologist, and it'll be done by a computer, not a human being. Studying IT ethics is a unique field of its own. It's building up. The thing is, the great thing about philosophers is that they can't even agree on what technology is. You know, they can't say, okay, what's the demarcation between technology and non-technology? Okay, and they agree that technology is the application of science. So science is trying to uncover what the world really is, how the world operates. But with technology, that's like, okay, now we're trying to put it in action. You know, how can the world be? What's the potential of the world? Robo-law, laws and regulations, they're so far behind the technology. And I see it in my field, and all these changes in technology and the laws and regulations and insurance implications, it's lagging so far behind all these amazing technological advances. I'm getting low on time here. Transhumanism, will robots with strong artificial intelligence be more capable than humans in the distant future? Machine learning, the idea is, like, how can we make robots smarter? Okay, show a robot how to do something, it's not going to be any smarter, but when we do something, we learn. Okay, so the idea is that machine learning, can we get these robots to become smarter and smarter and smarter? And then the whole issue of computationalism. Okay, is the human mind nothing more than an advanced computer program? Okay. And a lot of people, does that devalue the idea of a human brain? But a human brain is a combination of analog and digital actions. There's RNA, there's DNA, there's proteins, there's various molecules. Computers don't have that. Okay. But Ray Kurzweil and others say that it's just a matter of time that the human beings, that we'll be able to map this human brain, and these machines will surpass us. That's called the singularity, that they'll surpass us in ability. Others say, that's poppycock, there's too many differences between the human brain and the computer, and we don't buy that at all. Computer can't feel, computer doesn't have emotions, computer doesn't fall in love, computer can't enjoy a strawberry or an ice cream sundae, right? So, a couple quotes, the world's going to be shaped by four dynamic trends in the future, the genetics, nanotechnology, robotics, artificial intelligence. How are we going to deal with these inevitable forces? We hope in a cautious, in a methodical way, looking at the pros and cons. Gerhard Kosher, the future is clear to me. What I don't understand is the president, and one of my favorites, Albert Einstein, I never think of the future. It comes soon enough. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, unfortunately, I won't be around to say any of this. However, my theory as a philosopher and a lover of technology has been the solution to technological problems is more technology. And that's how we'll solve all these problems. They will be solved, but technology will solve them. And we will have to discover and invent new technologies, new ways of looking at what is human.
Right.
But we will solve them, and we will continue on. That's my prediction. You youngins, you'll be around. I won't.
Well, that just reminds me, Bob, that there's a theory. It's called the neutrality theory. Okay, the neutrality theory on technology says that technology is inherently neutral. It's not inherently good. It's not inherently bad. It's just how we use it. There have been some philosophers, Francis Bacon in the 18th century, he said that technology is inherently good because it can help improve the quality of life. Others say that it's just the opposite. We're looking at the atomic bomb, World War II, that is technology is inherently, or moving on the evil side rather than on the good side. But you're following Sir Francis Bacon, Bob. Good company.
I wanted to mention something that Ray Kurzweil is not the least bit concerned about, but many other people in the AI business are, is that when super AI reaches the point where it reaches the human level of intelligence,
right,
it is going to take off exponentially, and there are huge, huge dangers in that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do have some concerns about that. I just think one of the problems, Keith, is that if you can program these machines so that they're benign and that they follow certain rules, you know, one of the rules is I should never harm a human being, I will take my leave from a human being. If you can put in these various algorithms, then we may be able to avoid that. But when you think about robotics and computers, a lot is being, look at drones, it's being used in a military capacity. Okay, so if you're going to be more and more drones and robots are going to be, they're going to be used in the battlefields of the future. If you're going to use the programming for purposes like that, then there is more of a concern. But the idea is that a lot of, and Ray Kurzweil says there's about a 50-50 chance that that's going to happen.
Self-learning.
Yeah, the self-learning, yeah, all bets are off, and they're going to take, and that's what they're trying to do, is like teach these. But the concept is that there will be underlying algorithms that will override anything else, and those algorithms will say that thou shalt never harm a human being, thou shalt take instructions from a human being, but it's a slippery slope.
Self-learning algorithm can override.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The self-learning algorithm can override the other precepts that we just mentioned. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Me and Keith.
Your turn.
Go back and forth about this, but computers and all programmed devices, as in terms of technology, only have information that is given them by a programmer,
right,
a human being. And however advanced they become, they're never going to be more advanced than the programmer who programmed them. I don't believe that. No, they can program each other. They can program each other, but it all filters down from the original programmer. They cannot reproduce. I mean, I don't see them reproducing. I'm sorry. They're not DNA. They don't have DNA. They don't reproduce. And they don't experience their environment the same way a human being does. And the information that is in those bits and switches comes from a person originally. And they can never go beyond that. They are limited by that. So, I don't know, whatever.
Hey, Robert.
In support of what Mr. Berman said on the answers, more technology, there was a line out of RoboCop where he's been almost drilled through for his human parts with a spike or something, but he somehow survives and kills the other guy. You know, his former partner comes up to him and says, what are you doing? And he says, don't worry, they'll fix it. They always do. So the line of support, Mr. Berman said, but what I'd like to ask you is a little more scary. You have kind of the fact that sometimes these changes actually make the Neolithites look stupid, where, for example, what I do to databases, okay, I thought, oh my God, if we have computer-aided software engineering, it's going to get rid of the need for DBAs, the need for programmers. And in fact, of course, it makes the creation per hour, per man, month, whatever you want to call it, so cheap and so error-free that the cost of database is so cheap that the number demanded is just out the wazoo. DBA demand doubles every decade, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, though, you got those horses, you know, and you can have some optimistic, overly Panglossian horses just a little bit before the beginning of the 20th century saying, this Henry Ford guy is a little scary. He's putting us out of work. But remember the stuff we used to have to do? Jumping into wars and being shot at and pulling. Well, now we just, pet type jobs, and it's kind of fun. So we're still going to be taken care of, right? Yeah. But the glue factory, because like by 1915, they peaked, and then after that, there were fewer and fewer horses. Right. And what I'm suggesting is that it possibly is true that don't know if you've ever heard of these things called the Georgia Stones.
Oh, yeah,
guys. There's been all these conspiracy theories about when the government's going to kill us all off, because they talk about a population maximum of 500 million. That, by the way, is how many people we had in 1500.
Right.
Which doesn't sound like a good idea, that, you know, we need all these people right now. But what if in the short, very short future, where we're talking about this thing where artificial intelligence gets going real quickly, right, and the machines get so productive that the people that do own them really don't need as many of us anymore. I could see a sort of free market version where those Georgia Guidestones of 300, the 500,000 or 500 million number doesn't seem so stupid after all. Well, the really rich people that own those machines that bought stock in whatever it is, that out-Googles Google and out everything's everything, and makes everybody that owns that wealthier, makes the consumers that have the money to buy that wealthier. Well, they're all in. But, you know, the guys that what it used to be, well, you know, do you need me to code anymore? Sorry, you know. So what do you have? You probably thought about that a little bit, you know, during your lecture, before your lecture, et cetera. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's a real concern. But I temper that with the fact that we've been thinking about this, we've been thinking this is going to happen for 100, 200 years. And there used to be, farmers used to constitute about 60% of the American worker in the 1870s, something like that. Now it's less than 2%. But there is that concern, but I think also that I think our standard of living, if these are used wisely, will continue to go up, and we'll be able to, it's possible that we may have 30-hour work weeks in 20 years, and it's possible that we may be able to free up some of these mundane tasks that we have to do more high-level thinking, to do more non-repetitive type work. But that's there's a book that's out there, it's called The Second Machine Age, and that's its premise, Robert, is that all these simple analyst jobs are going to go away. So I think that's a possibility, but at the same time, I just looking at history, we've been just in thinking that technology is going to eliminate jobs for 100 plus years, and it hasn't really happened. So another possibility, in my opinion, is that it will free us up for doing more complex work, more creative work. And so I think that there is some positives to that as well. So I can see both sides, but I really think that our average work week, there's a company out there now, it's a software manufacturer, and they have a 4-day work week, 8 hours a day. They work 32 hours a week. And so the idea is that that may free us up for more leisure, for more pastimes, for more travel, things like that. But I think it's called, once again, it's called the digital divide. I think you're going to see the haves and the have-nots, and I think it's going to be getting bigger and bigger. Are you going to be controlled by the robot, the artificial intelligence, or are you going to be doing programming for that? And the idea, once again, is for us, for these simple analysts of today, the workers of today and the workers of tomorrow, is to work in collaboration with this technology to make it a better world. You know, very good question. I can see both sides of it, but I think there is that possibility that we could have higher unemployment. Yes.
A quick question. I was wondering, when I get the discussion between have and have-nots, I keep on wondering, these ultimately seem to me like political assets, which is something I think we're only touching on right here. If you have some sort of, say, super weapon, or
super what?
Super weapon. Uh-huh. Right. You know, I mean, I work in a DC area, and let me tell you, who has the biggest budget for these things? It's the people we don't mention. Right? You see what I'm saying?
The police department.
Yes. These people. Right. The ones we don't name. So, what's to prevent? I would say the U.S. is committed to the rule of law at some level, but why not, you know, the same situation with, Kim Jong Il, or people taking these technologies and taking them down to create them in 5 tons in Mexico, or other places. I mean, right now, today, I think it's something like 54% of women in India are illiterate. I mean, these are global issues. And I wonder, with either super weapons or militarization, or even in a situation where, as a person who can afford latest and greatest technologies for my own business, I'm going to outperform anybody
who can't keep up, like, just trying to capitalize expenditure.
Right, right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. I was reading an article about a man who worked and lived in India, and there's these big concrete walls that separate these compounds, these businesses, from some of the slums. And this man saw these kids playing around, and he got to thinking, you know, I wonder if I put a laptop computer in and put some, powered it up, and put it just the outside of this wall where all these kids play, these slums, if they would learn these computers, okay, 7, 8, 9-year-old boys and girls, and they did. They started playing around with it, and they just got really, really good at this. They were self-taught, okay? So if we can, it's called, there's a $100 computer out there. If we can have more and more kids have access to computers in some of these countries, these cheaper and cheaper computers, I think that bodes very, very well for the future of our world, because with computer literacy becomes a decrease in poverty. Your question about technology is an interesting one. There was many, many people that felt that when the atomic bomb was developed, that we would be gone, our species would be dead within 10 or 20 years, and hasn't happened. And there are others that say that technology has reduced wars, because we know that if we take another step, the whole human race will be decimated. So there's two ways of looking at it as far as the technology. But the concern that rogue people, rogue leaders, like what we have in North Korea or Iran, getting hold of some of this technology, that's a real concern.
That is a real concern.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
The world you're talking about, we are safer, we live longer, we are healthier, we solve a lot of birth problems, we have 1-pound babies. That,
yeah.
Who's going to feed all these people? Technology won't.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I didn't get into agriculture, but the productivity of these fields, these agricultural fields, is unbelievable. With mapping and with drones, some farms have got variants from the FAA to use drones. They can tell, you know, what part of their farm is drier than normal, what part of the farm needs pesticides or herbicides or anything like that. And the technologies with these automated farms and these gigantic farms, there's a farm in Kazakhstan that's like 1 million acres. Okay. So the productivity of these farmers is growing and growing and growing. So that's one possibility. And the other issue is if you have more literacy through computers and things like that, then with greater literacy is less poverty and a lower birth rate too. So the idea is that if you can increase the computer literacy of all these Indians and all these Pakistanis, then and all these kids in Africa, that's going to, and I know perhaps it sounds a little bit utopian, and I hear, I know there's some way of looking at the other side, but I think that there can be great strides made as far as agriculture and as far as literacy and numeracy, things like that, just with the increased access to these computers, these inexpensive computers. Hey, Jack.
So, Rob, I hope your thoughts about shorter work weeks finally comes true, because in the 70s, when I was still in university, a few hundred years ago, we were talking about this very thing in business school, that someday there'll be shorter work weeks and more time for leisure life. And I think what's happened in our recent lifetime is the people, there are fewer people with jobs. The ones that do have jobs are working longer and expected to have greater productivity. But that's really not my question here. The question has to do with, we hear a lot about technology. It's kind of dominates the media and conversation. I'm kind of curious, though, about in the last few months, there was an article in a magazine, is the internet making us stupid?
Yeah.
And there's another an attorney in New York that writes a lot about whether or not we have the capacity, or are we losing the capacity for deep immersion into topics? Do we have the attention span? So I'm kind of wondering, in the future, will our attention to the humanities, will our approach to spirituality be better, different? Are we still going to have 400 or 500-page novels that grapple with human life and the challenges that we have in living?
Well, I suspect that we will. I remember 15, 20 years ago, we started doing video conferencing in my business, and we were supposed to be, there would probably be, business travel would probably end. We would cut way, way, way back, okay, because there was all these computer screens, and this is many years ago. And yet, that hasn't been widely adopted, because people like that personalized approach. They like that touchy feeling. They got clients that are on the East Coast or the West Coast. They want to visit those clients. They want to shake their hands. They want to go out to dinner with them. They want to do all these different things. So there's still, I mean, technology is made great strides, and yet we're still social beings. We're still social animals that want to have that connectivity. And I don't really think that's going to change. And so you're going to still have great novels that are going to be written, in my opinion. Technology may be easier. You know, you don't have to carry all these books on your trip to Europe. You've got your wireless device and all. But I still think that we're, at the heart, even with the technology, we are social creatures that want that intimacy, that want that handshake, that hug. And that doesn't come with virtual reality.
Real quick interjection on that. Robert Bellin, I was just reading, you know, posed the question, could we imagine a funeral or a wedding done virtually?
Yeah, right.
Can I make one more tiny short comment?
Okay, and then Bob has a short one, then we're going to have to close.
I just have a short one. Because human beings still control and implement and utilize technology, unless human beings are taught to utilize and control it, and implement it correctly and in a broader way so that these technologies talk to each other, then it will harm us more than help us.
All right. Bob gets the last word as the first.
We are thinking of this problem in today's social economic institutions as we are living now. And as technology advances, social and economic institutions will change, and we will make new ones to fit so that we are going to survive. Even our planet, you know, can easily hold 8, 10 billion and more people, and we will solve these problems. So don't worry about it.
All right. Right here.